From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley, and this morning we first travel to the Salish Sea to learn more about the Discovery Islands and what a conservationist and island resident, Sheila Harrington, is doing to protect them. Sheila has just penned a new book called Voices for the Islands. Sheila, we're so glad that you joined us this morning on This Green Earth. And first, to start, we want to lay some foundational info. So we want to hear a little bit more about your background and exactly where the Salish Sea is.
Okay, sure. Well, for the last 30 years, I've been involved in conservation. I was the founding executive director of the Land Trust Alliance of BC. And so I've been working with land trusts for the last 30 years, protecting habitats and working on helping conservancies across BC and in the last while on the Salish Sea with their habitat protection and education programs. The Salish Sea, you asked where that was. Well, the Salish Sea is in between the mainland of British Columbia and the mainland of Washington State, and it goes from Seattle all the way up to Cortez Island and Quadra Island on the north end of the Salish Sea in British Columbia.
And specifically, we are discussing the Discovery Islands, and you are the habitant of one of those islands, correct?
Sort of, yes. That's a little bit further north than where I am, but I live on Laskeedy Island, which is actually referred to as the island in the middle of everywhere, because Laskeedy is in the middle of the Salish Sea. And, of course, in the days when Indigenous people lived and worked here, they often gathered here and exchanged things here because it was right in the middle of the Salish Sea.
And you have penned this new book called Voices for the Islands, which brings together all these stories that chronicle conservancies there and the islands themselves. And you take us over the course of about four decades.
Yes, that's correct. Many of these organizations were started by people who realized that they could do something to stop the destruction of habitats on their own islands. Interestingly, a lot of them participated in the Clackwat Sound protests back in the mid-90s, and so they came back to their own islands and discovered that, you know, their islands were just as at risk as was the forest in Clackwat Sound. So many of them on Galliano and Denman and Hornby immediately started, the people immediately started gathering together with others in their community and working to protect the lands that were at risk on Denman and Galliano, specifically from logging. And then as the years went by, of course, it was more development that were the threats on the islands.
And can you talk us through the ecosystem there? It is a rather fragile ecosystem in those islands. Can you give us a lay of the land?
Sure. Most of these islands are in what's called the coastal Douglas fir zone, and it's critically imperiled. There's less than 1% of the intact forest left in this zone, the coastal Douglas fir zone. A little bit of the islands on the mainland over near Howe Sound is in the western hemlock zone, which is a little bit wetter area than the coastal Douglas fir, which is quite a dry ecosystem, actually, and the western hemlock is a little bit wetter, and so some of the lands over in Howe Sound, which is now a biosphere reserve called the Atkinson Sound Biosphere Reserve, have a little bit more lush forest, actually, although, of course, they were logged a little bit earlier than some of us on the islands, because it's harder to get the timber out of here. But needless to say, certainly there was a lot of logging went on. And yes, many of the stories in this book talk about the individuals who got together with others and raised funds in order to buy these lands.
Yeah, so it's called Voices for the Islands. Who are these voices, and are they longtime inhabitants? Are they new people that have come in and noticed these problems that the islands are having? Who are you talking about?
Yes, well, actually, the reason I started the book was because a few of the original founders of these organizations, which are called land trusts, and of course there's many land trusts in the U.S., were aging, and so I realized a few of them, of course, had already passed on. So I realized that I needed, and I was in a great position because I knew these people. I wanted to interview them and get their stories about, you know, what were the things that happened that motivated them to take action and protect these habitats. And I interviewed probably over 75 people, and many of them, of course, by my sailboat, because I went sailing over 3 years to all the islands to interview these people and meet these people. And then, of course, some others I interviewed by telephone afterwards. Many of them came from other places, but have, you know, for the last 20, 30 years been living on these islands.
Now, I think it's interesting that you decided to sail there and go face to face. And did that give them maybe a little bit more trust or understanding of what you were trying to accomplish with this?
Yeah, although many of them knew me in the first place because of my work with the Land Trust Alliance previously. Yeah, I'm sure, and it was just a joy to meet some of these people. I'll just give you an example on Gabriola, which was my first island I went to from here. I met with seven past presidents of the Gabriola Lands and Trails Trust, and I mean, it was amazing to me that I could get seven people together at the same time and that they were willing to come and talk to me. And so that was a good example. On other islands, I had to meet with people individually, but people were very willing to talk to me, and they wanted to share their stories.
And can you give us an example of one of the more compelling stories that you heard?
Sure. I'm going to give you my favorite example because it involves myself, of course. I was living on Salt Spring Island, a different island, the more populated island. And a property that was extensive, it was basically 10% of the island, had changed hands from previously it was owned by someone from Europe, and you know, there was some logging that had happened there, but it was fairly minimal. It certainly hadn't affected the entire ecosystem there. But the fellow died, and the land changed hands, and suddenly it was in the hand of two developers, and their intentions were to clear the timber and pay back the mortgages that they'd taken out to buy the land through clearing the timber, and then build fancy estates on the hillside. And it was a whole bay, and the hillside surrounding the bay that was affected. And so people on the island took action. We met with the developers and asked questions about what their plans were, and then, you know, told them, well, there'd been groups of organizations and government meeting for 5 years to consider how we could protect this land because it was the most intact land on the island. And then over 2 and 3 years, the community got together. They worked with several land trusts, actually, and raised the money to buy the lands eventually. But it took a lot. It took people actually taking their clothes off. We made a calendar that raised $100,000 for a particular area, actually the watershed for the island. And then kind of one of the more dramatic events was Bryony Penn, who was with myself involved in the project from the start. We went to Vancouver, and she rode on a horse topless in front of the developers' offices. And, of course, that brought in a lot of media. And so at that point, the reason we did that was because they kept raising the price of the land while the negotiations were going on. And so that eventually the Capital Regional District, which is kind of like your counties, they backed out of negotiations because they were getting frustrated. But after this, you know, topless horse riding event, they came back to the table feeling quite chagrined. And in the end, negotiations were successful.
Well, let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Sheila Harrington. She's the author of the new book, Voices for the Islands. We're talking about the islands, the many, many islands that dot the Salish Sea off the coast of British Columbia. And Sheila, is that an ongoing theme as far as a problem now these days, that developers are coming in and of course, everybody loves those that area of the country, and they want to move there, they want to live there. But are the islands being kind of developed and loved to death, as an example?
Oh, yes, I would say in many cases that's true. And it's not just developers now. It's actually individuals. And I just want to also remind your audience that it's not just British Columbia. The Salish Sea includes Washington State, right, and the islands down there, the San Juan Islands as well, although my book focuses on the Canadian islands. Mm. But the problems are the same, is that people come, they move here, and they start acting quickly without actually taking the time to look around and figure out, what is this ecosystem I live in? You know, where's the water systems going through here? And often they just clear the land and start building anew and putting in exotic trees or species, you know, often that come from where they used to live. And so one of the interesting things that these conservancies or land trusts do, in many of them, is they're offering walkabouts so that when a new person comes to the land or the island, they can get in touch with them, and the group will send a representative or two to walk around the property with them and, you know, talk about what's their vision for what they want to do, and then, you know, what do they see? What is the habitats here? What are the important areas to protect? And, you know, what are some of the techniques you can use to mitigate your impacts? So that's an exciting thing, and they offer these projects for free, I mean, this program for free to landowners, just to encourage them to get in touch with these people and take the time to get to know the natural areas that they've come here to live in.
It is interesting to see that people do want to live there, but then they want to also change it to conform almost to their wants and desires. What are some of those impacts that you have seen from past developments that have been a little detrimental to the ecosystem?
Oh, well, the impacts start with logging. You know, they're cutting the trees down, and then, of course, that changes the ecosystem overall, but it even changes the immediate area because they've just lost all the shade those trees were giving. And, of course, as the climate is heating up, and especially here it's heating up, you know, they're losing their shade, and then they're losing the erosion control that those trees offered. And then, of course, you know, sometimes there's canaling that goes on so that you can have agricultural areas. And there's even impacts, especially along the waterfront, where people are building up with the fear of the oceans rising. At this point, it's not actually that extensive yet, but because of it and because of the increasing storms, people are putting bulkheads up, some kind of way that they're trying to protect their property. But in fact, it does the opposite, because if they just let the natural shoreline work, then what it mitigates those impacts from the waves. But if they put up, you know, big bulkheads, rock walls, things like that, then as the tide comes in and as the waves come in, they actually pull away underneath where the sands are, and so it actually erodes it more. So it's better not to do that kind of thing. But people don't realize that. I mean, it's understandable. They're wanting to protect their properties. So that's a major impact I'm seeing on these islands. But, you know, it includes the forests and the wetlands as well.
Are you seeing invasive species also migrating into that area, whether they're brought in by development or say, warmer conditions? I'm thinking plants or even insects.
Oh, yes. Invasive species has been a problem since us colonials came here, you know, bringing all these different species.
The original invasive species, right, Sheila?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, there's a lot of that going on as well. And, you know, there's lots of programs, and these organizations and other organizations are working on restoration, where they're trying to look at these invasive species and figure out, you know, how to get rid of them, or, you know, whether or not some of them might be better left in some cases. And here on the coast, we've got a green crab infestation that's becoming a bit of a problem. So, yeah, that's definitely a problem. But in terms of individual ability to do something, of course, anybody can help with those kinds of works, and it's always fun and rewarding to get out with other people and do something that makes a difference. But in terms of people owning land, you have the capacity to do something on your own land. And something we haven't talked about yet, in the U.S. they're called easements. In Canada they're called covenants, conservation covenants. An individual landowner can protect a section of their land, if they have, you know, a bigger area of land, obviously, by registering an easement or covenant on their land that runs with the land. So when they sell, if they have, like, let's say they had 10 acres of land, if they got 5 acres in forest and they put the covenant on that 5 acres, that 5 acres will be protected well into the future because it runs with the title. So as soon as they sell, that same property, that same area will be protected.
You know, we only have a few more minutes, and you mentioned the green crab, which makes me think, you know, the ecosystem includes the water, too. Does your work or the land trust work include conservation efforts with respect to marine life?
Absolutely. One of the chapters in the book focuses on Saturna Island. And Saturna Island, which is the furthest south island in the Canadian islands, is right on the border, that island, their work is completely focused on, well, not completely, but majorly focused on education and awareness and scientific work about the ocean, and especially about the marine mammals, because off of Saturna there's very big currents through Boundary Pass there, and that's where a lot of the marine mammals will congregate at certain times of year, and they have speakers and audio phones set there, so they're actually recording the whales as they go by, and eventually, because their work has become so respected, that the governments are actually seeking out their knowledge and seeking out their evidence. Unfortunately, of course, not doing as much about it as they should in terms of trying to protect things. Like right now in Vancouver, of course, we have this big port expansion that is being approved, and then also, of course, the big Trans Mountain pipeline, which has increased tenfold the freighters going into Vancouver, and of course that completely affects the whales, because they find their way and they find food through sound, and with all those freighters going through, it's affecting them.
And I'm sorry, and that Trans Mountain pipeline, that's with respect to crude oil?
Yes.
Coming, okay.
Bitumen oil, actually.
Bitumen, right, right.
Yeah.
A lot of challenges. We haven't even touched on if the local fishing industry is stressing the environment too, or is that not as big of an issue as, say, relative to logging and development?
Well, yeah, the main thing that actually is one of the islands, Hornby Island here, is focused on the herring, because now there is only one commercial herring fishery left in the Salish Sea, because the herring have been wiped out over the last 70 years. And we've kind of thought that the salmon were at the core of everything, but it turns out, in fact, the herring are at the core of everything, because, of course, everything eats the herring, and that they've now got archaeological evidence proving that there were far, you know, the herring were so abundant here, and, of course, the fishery in the past pretty much wiped that out. And so this Hornby group is really trying to advocate for ending that commercial herring fishery, or at least changing the way it's done, because there's only this little bit left.
Well, Sheila.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, Sheila, you're right. No herring, no salmon, right? Because the herring are the foundational species to the rest of the food chain as you go up. So everything else, there, that ripple effect associated with the loss of herring. That's interesting.
Yeah, and herring and other fish called forage fish, which actually come up on the beaches. And so here we have the landowners again. They lay their eggs on the beaches. And so these forage fish, sand lance and surf smelt. And so when people go drive on the beaches, well, they're killing the future fish. Or, you know, because some people are doing that, or, you know, if they're impacting the beaches, then that affects the forage fish, which affects the salmon, which affects the whales.
Yeah.
So it's all these ripple effects that are happening, literally. And many of them obviously stem from human impact. So when people read this book, what is the biggest takeaway that you want people to receive?
That people can make a difference, that we can really make a difference. And so all these stories in this book are about people making a difference. And people have got back to me saying they've got renewed hope after reading the book because they feel like, you know, there are people out there working away, and many of them voluntarily. I mean, I've been working voluntarily on this now for the last 15 years. I'm now retired, but still, all the board members of Land Trust are all working voluntarily. But what it is it's successful. It's succeeding. They're able to buy these lands. In many cases, they do have to work with larger land trusts or sometimes with governments to purchase the lands. For example, here in BC, the most recent group is called the BC Parks Foundation, and they have been saving land like crazy in the last 2 years. So it's all something we can do.
All right. Sheila Harrington, author of the book Voices for the Islands. Sheila, is there a website our listeners can go to learn more about your work?
Well, there's a website you can go to learn more about the book. I don't have my own website, right. And that's Heritage House is the publisher, and then you just Voices for the Islands, and then information about the book and where one can get it comes up.
All right. That's perfect. Sheila Harrington, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And thank you for all the work you do and
Absolutely.
Have done over these decades. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Okay. Thank you for speaking with me today.
And joining us for the second part of the show, Ken Goodson. He's the director of the National Civilian Community Corps for AmeriCorps.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining Clara and myself this morning. Let's start with AmeriCorps in general, and then we'll kind of drill down from there. What is AmeriCorps about? What's the work they do?
Wonderful. So AmeriCorps is about service and volunteerism, about giving back to our nation and also having those who are serving gain skills that will help fulfill and enrich their own lives. We are actually celebrating our 30th anniversary as an agency this year. We have programs around the country that work at the community and grassroots level. And I work for one of the four major programs under the AmeriCorps umbrella.
Wow, 30 years. That went by fast. Because I didn't think you were around. Started in 1994, but that's the case.
That's the case, indeed.
Yeah. So give us an example of some of the work that AmeriCorps does, perhaps out here in the Mountain West.
Sure. Actually, I just had the good fortune of being not too far from where you all are based a few weeks ago, visiting one of our newest programs. So let me speak to that.
Yeah.
You introduced me at the onset as the director of the National Civilian Community Corps, yep. or what I'll refer to as NCCC. NCCC is one of the four major programs under the AmeriCorps umbrella. It is a team-based service program for 18 to 26-year-olds. We actually started as a demonstration project at the Department of Defense before being moved over to AmeriCorps 30 years ago. But we recently have gotten into an agreement at the request of the USDA Forest Service, the United States Forest Service, to support them in advancing their wildfire crisis strategy and also their reforestation strategy. So we have launched a new program, which is called Forest Corps, which is working across the Mountain West, including two teams in Utah, the Uinta-Wasatch-Cache National Forest, helping to advance those goals of the U.S. Forest Service.
Yeah, and so reforestation being one of them. So what would the Forest Corps members be doing with the Forest Service?
Yeah, the work of the teams is always going to be defined by the host forest. And the very first Forest Corps visit I was able to do was actually to Uinta Wasatch Cache, and the forest supervisor, forest ranger, and the team at that national forest are just doing an excellent job in using the team to meet the needs that they have. It can look like a variety of different things, and the work can be quite diverse. It can be reforestation projects. It can be doing surveys of forests to help assess the health of trees. At Uinta Wasatch Cache, there's a lot of recreation facilities, such a beautiful area and accessible to many, many of your listeners. So they can do some rehabilitation and upgrade work on the recreation facilities. And when I was there, they were actually doing electrofishing, which is shocking the fish to be able to do a count and see how healthy the streams are in that particular national forest. So it's a wide variety of diverse work.
Yeah, and when one joins the Forest Corps, what is the commitment associated with that membership or becoming a member?
Yeah, great question. So Forest Corps is a 1,700-hour service commitment, full-time service commitment, and that is achieved through 10 months of service for the young adults who are in the program. Not all of the service commitment is direct hands-on field work. There is onboarding and training that happens from both AmeriCorps and the United States Forest Service, and then there's training that happens throughout the course of the service term to continue to strengthen and fine-tune the skills of the AmeriCorps members in the program, in part because the program was launched both to meet immediate needs of the Forest Service, but also to serve as a pipeline of potential employees, young adults who could be eligible to move into entry-level positions with the Forest Service following their service term with AmeriCorps.
And what does that interest look like at that age range between 18 and 26-year-olds? Are you seeing a lot of activity and want to be a part of the Forest Service?
Oh, my God, this is like the greatest question. And there's two things when, you know, anytime you launch a new AmeriCorps program, there's two things that are like your absolute must-haves for success. You have to have, interested partners with whom you serve. We're seeing really strong demand for teams. But to your question, the second is you have to have young adults, in our case, 18 to 26-year-olds, who are interested in this type of service. And you never know until the program is actually launched. In our case, we had 80 positions for the first cohort, and we received over 800 applications for those positions. So the demand is super strong. And then I think what has surprised us as we go through the first couple of months of the actual service experience is that the retention rate in the program is sky high. So it's a great question, and our initial indicators, still early in the program, but our initial indicators are really positive as to the interest of young adults.
We're speaking with Ken Goodson. He's the director of the National Civilian Community Corps for AmeriCorps. And we're talking about the AmeriCorps projects and programs and how you become a member of it, get involved in AmeriCorps and the Forest Corps specifically, and the work that they're doing out here in Utah. Now, I'm assuming that there are other Forest Corps projects going on around the Mountain West or the U.S. West?
There are, and your question sort of alludes to where they are. The teams are now are Utah, Idaho, Oregon, and California, and those are placements that are determined by the Forest Service based on where they believe they have the greatest need to advance their wildfire crisis strategy and reforest. But the teams will move, so they'll serve, for example, in Uinta Wasatch Cache for several months. But then they will go back to our base of operations, get a little more training, and then head off to another forest so that over the course of their service commitment, they get a diverse set of experiences and exposure to a variety of different forests, again, so that they can become competitive candidates to apply for entry positions with the Forest Service.
Oh, okay. So this can be used as kind of a stepping stone to pursue a more full-time career in, like you say, perhaps in the Forest Service itself.
Definitely. I think if you looked at the two main reasons that the Forest Service approached AmeriCorps and CCC 2 years ago, one of them very much was to meet the front burner needs of the wildfire crisis strategy and reforestation strategy. But equally important was the Forest Service interest in being able to develop a pipeline of candidates who could serve as the future entry-level employees for the Forest Service or for other land management agencies. So over the course of their service term in AmeriCorps, the Forest Service is actually training, providing certifications and credentials to the young adults who are serving in the program. And to your point, the idea is that then at the end of their service term, they're a competitive candidate for positions with the Forest Service or similar such organizations.
And when you talk about training, is there not only in the field training, but also are they learning more about climate change, how it's affecting the forests, how to mitigate this? Like, what does that training look like?
Hmm. Yeah, so we partner up with the Forest Service to deliver the training. On the AmeriCorps side of things, I mentioned a little bit earlier, we're a team-based program for young adults. AmeriCorps and CCC is. So we provide training for young adults on how to be successful in a team setting, conflict resolution, how to live on a budget, and some of the health and safety procedures that we have in place so that members can not only serve, but serve safely during their service term. And then the Forest Service will provide the technical training, so red card certification for wildland firefighting, chainsaw certification, things like that. And then we do look to connect any of the work that teams are doing on the day-to-day to the bigger picture of what are we trying to achieve. So the young adults are going through the program, and maybe the team there at Uinta Wasatch Cache, for example, is learning a lot about that particular part of the country and the forest in that part of the country, but they're also learning about the larger increase in both wildfires and intensity of wildfires that we've experienced over the past decade.
So I love that you get that foundational connection to what it looks like to work with a group or a team, and then you get the basic skill set with hands-on. So it sounds like you're covering a lot of the bases, which I wish everyone could do.
Take advantage of
it. Yes.
We've been quite fortunate. It is a space where AmeriCorps programs have long been successful in the conservation space. So we do, you know, we benefit greatly both from wonderful partners at the Forest Service, but we also benefit from the fact that many AmeriCorps programs have worked successfully and done great work in this space.
Yeah, I mean, we've been focusing on Forest Service level work and work out here in the American West. But the AmeriCorps is, you know, 50 states in coverage, I'm guessing, whether it's land-based or maybe even marine-based or other ecosystems?
Yeah, that's correct. If there is an unmet community need, AmeriCorps pretty much has a program that can work to support and address it. And in a state like yours, you know, Utah is famous for having the highest rate of volunteerism in the United States, which is, you know, what a wonderful reputation to have. So a lot of opportunities to give back, and not just in the environmental space, right? Things like helping ensure people have affordable housing, making sure that the basic needs like hunger are addressed. AmeriCorps is on the front edge of helping communities address their most pressing needs and identified priorities.
Right. So AmeriCorps may not just be out, you know, in the woods, let's say, but they can also be members of or doing work within urban settings.
Very much. Yes.
Yeah.
And even under the AmeriCorps and CCC umbrella, the program where I work, we have a program stream called FEMACorps. That is entirely about disaster response and preparedness. And then we have what we call our traditional program that's been around for 30 years. And that focuses very heavily on community identified priorities. And it can really run the gamut between immediately responding to the devastation of a tornado to actually doing tax prep work for families making less than $50,000 to help them get a return.
Wow, it's really helping to fill gaps where there otherwise there may be a shortage of full-time employees to address or budgetary constraints. Like you say, with respect to the Forest Service, they're out there assisting full-time Forest Service employees on research, like you say, surveys, maybe helping with other projects that the Forest Service might not be able to accomplish otherwise.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about it. And I was really struck when I had a chance to spend time in Uinta Wasatch Cache that the Forest Service staff, who was kind enough to host me that day and show me around, on a couple of occasions noted that they had projects that were slated to be completed in the summer of 2025. So these were projects that were on track to be finished next summer, but that thanks to the Forest Corps teams, those projects had actually been completed this summer. So the ability to accelerate that work is obviously great for the Forest Service, but certainly contributes to the health of the forest in such a wonderful and beautiful area like where you all get to call home.
Yes.
And you did have this overwhelming, I guess, group of applicants that came in. How do you see this growing? I know that you can only place so many, but do you see this scaling up so that you can have more 18 to 26-year-olds be a part of this?
Yes. I mean, I would love that. I would love that. I also think that I've worked previously in the startup space, and the notion of small is beautiful was one that we sort of grabbed onto together with our Forest Service partners that, let's start small. Let's start with 80, in part because we don't know what the applicant pool, is there going to be interest? And then we don't know how the experience is going to go for the host forest. So let's start small at a manageable scale, position ourselves to be able to iron out any kinks or bumps in the road that emerge, and then assess what's our ability to scale. But obviously, if you've got 800 applicants for 80 slots, that is a considerable number of young adults who are looking to give back, looking to serve, and I would, in my dream world, all of them are given that, afforded that opportunity so that they can have the experience and make this type of difference for our country.
Yeah, that's a definite positive, is to see how young people are stepping up, but it is something that obviously is very affecting of their generation. And they have definitely, I think, been our generation to stand up and say, okay, we're going to make a difference. We're going to look even closer at our environment and how we steward it.
Sure. And Ken, you just use the term that strikes me, that small is beautiful. E.F. Schumacher's book by that name, Small is Beautiful. And that was the book back in the late 70s, early 80s that got me to that, and Silent Spring and other, books matter type of moment that got me turned into onto the environment and why I became an environmental engineer. So
right,
I like that. I like that a lot. Ken, we only have another minute or two. We'll give you the last word and perhaps let our listeners know how they can learn more about AmeriCorps
sure.
and Forest Corps.
Sure. Well, thank you again for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity, and I would certainly welcome continuing the conversation
sure.
as the program gets its legs further underneath itself. AmeriCorps.gov will provide information on the agency and different service opportunities that exist across the country. We were talking about the Forest Corps, so that is AmeriCorpsNCCC.gov/Forest Corps. And if you can head there, you can provide any information that would be requested to help people learn more about the program, including potentially signing up to serve.
All right. Ken Goodson, Director of the National Civilian Community Corps for AmeriCorps. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Ken. Yeah, we appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.